I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a proposal to do away with employer-based insurance and let everyone buy their own with a government voucher. But first, what's next after last night's Michigan primary? Mitt Romney handily beat his Republican opponents, taking 39% of the vote. Senator John McCain came in second with 30. Mike Huckabee took 16%. Meanwhile, the Democratic frontrunners held a low-key debate in Nevada last night, where Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama agreed to stop trading barbs over race. We turn to senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, Richard Wolff. He's on the campaign trail in Nevada. Richard, did Clinton and Obama really sort of bury the hatchet last night?
Yes, there was an outbreak of nice. They all decided that to take a step back. So, you know, having seen all the emotion about race especially come up over the last few days, they specifically stepped back from that. They also talked about Iraq and about their leadership qualities, but really, compared to the other debates, especially that last debate in New Hampshire where there was a lot of emotion going back and forth, this was a pretty tame affair. And I think it points to a bigger issue in Nevada, which is that nobody really knows where this race lies here. They don't know how many people are going to show up to what is really the first contested caucus in the state's history.
And why else is Nevada so pivotal?
The whole point of having Nevada at this point in the cycle was to get people thinking about Western issues, in theory it was to introduce the aspect of Latino interests, but actually the most sort of regional specific issue here has been the housing market, because especially in the Vegas area there's been high growth in the housing market, and that growth has come to a stunning halt recently with the collapse of the housing market. So that's something all the candidates were talking about last night.
Richard, you say there was sort of, you know, civility broke out at the Democratic debate, so much so that when the panelists tried to ask the candidates about the recent to and fro about race, a heckler in the audience got angry. Let's listen.
Senator Clinton.
We do not want these race-based questions coming from you two. These are race-based questions.
So that's a heckler at the debate accusing NBC's Brian Williams and Tim Russert of fomenting the issue of race. Do you think the spat between the two frontrunners, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, over race, and in fact, you know, the race question of the candidates, do you think that's gone?
No, I don't. Emotions are too high, and I think it's just going to bubble up another time. If not now, then next week.
Well, let's look at the Republican side. Obviously, Mitt Romney, a big win. What's been the reaction to how big it was?
People are scratching their heads. I think we need one of those giant IBM computers to figure out how this is headed and what's going on here. Three different winners for three different states. Republicans in general are really not coalescing around a single theme or a single candidate in this election.
Well, Nevada's caucus on Saturday is an important race for Democrats. The Republicans are virtually ignoring it, although Time magazine reports today that Mitt Romney may take advantage of that and try to scoop up the Nevada delegates. Meanwhile, he's campaigning in South Carolina today for the Republican primary, which is also on Saturday. What do the Republicans have to do in South Carolina?
Well, South Carolina, again, a high number of high participation of social conservatives. This is clearly where McCain tripped up last time, not least because he launched an attack on the whole social conservative movement, the Christian conservative movement in 2000. He's done a lot of work to repair relations down there. And I suspect Mitt Romney is not going to be talking about the economy down there. He'll be talking about his personal faith.
And, of course, Mitt Romney's personal faith is Mormonism, and he's been trying to reach out to evangelicals. But you mentioned McCain, you know, tripped up, but he also was, some would say, shoved by that ugly rumor campaign in 2000 about whether or not he had, you know, a love child. He has an adopted child. Is there a residue of that ugliness still in that area?
You know what? I have to say those kinds of tactics are prevalent throughout in all these races, everywhere. I mean, you have emails going back and forth about Barack Obama's alleged Muslim connections because his grandfather was a Muslim, even though he was practicing and a member of a church in Chicago for 20 years. So this kind of stuff, I think, has become facilitated by the Internet, by email. All of these were a factor in what happened to John McCain in 2000 in South Carolina. It sadly has become just part and parcel of campaigning everywhere, and especially in a close race Campaigns are trying to do whatever it takes.
That's Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, speaking to us from Nevada ahead of this weekend's caucuses. Richard, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the need for health care reform was mentioned in passing in last night's Democratic debate and has been a theme on the trail. Our next guest says he has an idea that should appeal to both sides of the political aisle. Lawrence Kotlikoff says he was at a conference a while back when he learned that the son of former Supreme Court Justice and Republican Sandra Day O'Connor is one of the country's 45 million uninsured. He can't afford insurance because his son, her grandson, has a pre-existing condition. Well, Boston University economist Kotlikoff says he's come up with a plan that Republicans ought to like because it's market-based and liberals ought to like because it's progressive. In his plan, every American would receive a government voucher to buy their own insurance. His critics say Kotlikoff's plan would create a huge government bureaucracy. His book is called The Healthcare Fix, and we want to ask more. He's here in the studio. Welcome, Larry.
It's great to be here.
Let's start with just real, get it right out there. How would your voucher system work? You call it the medical security system. You get a voucher from the government or a check? What is it?
Everyone gets a piece of paper from the government. There's no longer Medicare, Medicaid, and the employer-based healthcare system. We're starting from scratch. Everybody gets a voucher in October. By January 1st, they've used the voucher to buy a health insurance policy from an insurance company, which will cover them for the course of the year. Now, the key thing about this voucher is that if you're perfectly healthy, you get a small voucher. If you're somebody with a pre-existing condition like diabetes, you'll get a big voucher. So the size of the voucher will be based on your expected health care costs.
Can your voucher get bigger as you get older? Because I'm thinking you might be healthy at one point, but then not.
Absolutely. Every year, you'll get a new voucher based on your current health situation.
And who determines that? Who determines your need?
The government would look at how your objective health tests and other indicators, like the prescription drugs you're taking, how these things predict how much you're going to cost the insurance companies. So they will base the voucher based on this medical information that they'll be receiving electronically from your doctors and your pharmacists. So the government will, what we call experience rate or risk rate, each individual.
Like insurance companies do.
Just like insurance companies do. And then the insurance companies will have no incentive to not try and insure somebody with diabetes because that person with diabetes might be coming with a $100,000 voucher.
Because right now, insurance companies are accused of cherry-picking, only taking the healthy clients and dropping others. Well, let's hold you up there, because we've got a lot of questions. Yeah. First of all, you say eliminate Medicaid and Medicare and using that money to provide these vouchers. Many of your critics say, but wait a minute, these programs work. Ted Marmer, a professor at Yale, has said that Medicare has a record of controlling costs better than the private sector.
Well, that may be the case, but the Medicare system by itself can drive this country broke. It's the benefit level has been growing about 2.5 times the rate of per capita GDP. If this continues, there won't be any money for anything. Medicaid has expanded by 35% since 2000 in terms of enrollments, and those costs are also, those benefit levels per person are also going out the roof. So we have a history with these programs where it's just greater and greater spending with no control. The voucher plan is going to control costs because the government would put a lid on the total voucher expenditure and keep it fixed as a share of GDP.
Okay, let's jump in there. I can hear people saying, I don't want the government to know, first of all, know my private business. They do if you're on Medicare or Medicaid, but otherwise don't. And I don't want some bureaucrat deciding my need based on, you know, his or her sense of, you know, my past medical experience. And I don't want a bloated government. I don't. That's just another bloated government agency filled with these people determining my needs.
First of all, the government is already covering a third of the population under Medicare and Medicaid and has all the records, really, that it, if it wanted to start revealing people's personal medical conditions to somebody, it could do it. It has all this information. So I think that's really a non-issue. The government has this information on lots of people and is keeping it very private and will continue to do that. Now, when you talk about bloated government, I'm trying to unbloat government. I'm trying to have an efficient single system because what we're headed to is a Medicare system, a Medicaid system, and yet a third Medicare-type system for the 49 million uninsured. And probably that will turn into many more people than 49 million covered by that third government program, because if that program is generous and really works, then all the people that are covered by the employers, they'll probably be moving into that system. So we're in the end, we're going to have government running everything anyway. The question is whether we're going to do it in a bankrupt condition, or whether we're going to go from here to there with incredible costs, or whether we're going to get everybody under the same tent and do it in a very efficient way that lets the market help us.
And you say also that this, your plan, will get employers out of the health insurance business, and some employers are being strangled by it. And some would say, you know, they're already getting out of it because they've been cutting back on premiums. Some companies just can't afford it. Employees may be provided insurance, but they can't afford the amount that's been shifted to them. So
we have
that's
an absolute crisis. We have a crisis of excessive growth of spending by Medicare and Medicaid. We have a crisis of with the employers not being able to afford what's going on. And then we have 49 million people uninsured. We have a total, complete mess in the healthcare system. We need to have one efficient, sensible system which fixes the underlying problem with this market. We don't have a market problem in apples. The Apple market works perfectly fine. But this market has an information problem, and insurers don't want to insure people they don't know about because they think this person might have diabetes. So this gets – what I'm talking about is a voucher plan that's going to get rid of that information problem. It's going to deal with what's called the adverse selection problem, and then the market will be able to compete.
Let me ask you a question, though. If you're going to shift so much to the government, again, in this consolidated government agency that's going to determine voucher size – why not get rid of the insurance companies altogether? Because you say that the way the voucher is going to work, if I've got it right, if the insured, if with their voucher, costs the companies more than their voucher, then the company loses. They just have to pay. It'll be balanced by if the insured costs the company less. In other words, they turn out to be healthier than their balance, then the insurance companies get that money. But doesn't that leave it wide open for insurance companies to cut corners, to say, oh, look, this person's got a voucher. I'm not going to recommend some healthcare stuff to them because I can get that money from the voucher. I already know how much money this person could bring to my company.
Medicare is, in effect, giving vouchers. They just don't have any control over the total cost. Medicaid is, in effect, giving people signing people up with healthcare plans. This is Part D. Medicare is signing people up with insurance companies. So we're talking about a system that's already in place. We're just talking about having one system. The reason I want to keep insurance companies in the game here is not because I think they're the greatest companies in the world, but because they will compete to provide the most efficient policies. This company might decide it wants to specialize in diabetics. This company may want to sign up providers that are very good with people with arthritis. So you have a real role here for insurance providers to provide an efficient set of policy provisions. In addition, no insurance company will be allowed to turn anybody down. That'll be another part of this proposal.
That's Boston University economics professor Lawrence Kotlikoff. His book is The Healthcare Fix, and in it he proposes getting rid of Medicare and Medicaid, using that money and funds from a rejiggered tax system, switching from an income tax, for instance, to a consumer tax or a so-called fair tax, and using some of those monies as well to fund a program in which every American would get a voucher and go out and buy their own health insurance. As he just said, he thinks the insurance companies will compete and bring down the costs. But some are asking, if you're going to have the government so involved, why not just get rid of the insurance companies altogether? We'll ask him that question. And later in the program, staying with the topic of health, we'll remember Dr. Judah Folkman, the pioneering cancer researcher who died suddenly yesterday. Will his work go on? Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with Boston University economist Lawrence Kotlikoff. His new book is called The Healthcare Fix. In it, he argues for universal health insurance for all Americans by getting rid of Medicare and Medicaid and instead having the government give every American annual vouchers to buy health insurance based on their need. And that need would be determined by the government. Insurers would be required to offer a basic policy to everyone. Kotlikoff says that would stop what he calls the adverse selection that's going on now, when companies cherry pick the healthiest and least costly people to insure. Professor Kotlikoff also says the tax system would need to be overhauled, replaced with a single flat tax on all sales and services in this country in order to help pay for the vouchers. And Larry, let's keep going. Federal health economists say that private insurers typically have higher administrative costs than Medicare. Your plan, it seems, has not one, but now it would have two agencies which would decide what health care you need. First, the government, which would decide how well you are, you know, or how sick you are, and determine how much money you'd get in your voucher. And then the private insurance company, which would then decide which treatment you deserve to get. And isn't that a correct reading?
The government would have a panel, not of politicians, but of practitioners, that would say there's a basic policy. Every insurance company would have to provide that, and that panel would be there to deal with disputes. So the government would set the amount of money, and it would set a set of coverages that would correspond to the average premium that's being provided, the average voucher size, so that the insurance companies would make a small profit, but they wouldn't, go to town on this. And there'd also be a very efficient collection of electronic medical records here, so that if you went from one provider to another, that provider would immediately have access to your whole medical history, because it would all be electronically maintained by a computer sitting in some big building in Washington, D.C. I picture a big floor in the HHS building, Health and Human Services, and there's just this little computer collecting all this information and doing all the risk adjusting and then sending out the vouchers. Doesn't even have to be done by a human.
And that's one of the things that does worry people, that it's just a computer sitting in Washington deciding their health issues.
It would be a panel that would really decide if this particular procedure should be, whether heart transplants for a 90-year-old should be included as covered under the voucher. If somebody wants to buy supplemental coverage for things that aren't covered by the voucher, they'd be free to do that. Huh. So that's part of the plan, too.
You say that it's essentially impossible to limit growth in Medicare spending. That's one of your big concerns, that Medicare and Medicaid are on the road to...
It's the way these things are structured. This fee-for-service system says that my mom, for example, is 88. Mm-hmm. If she wanted to see 14 doctors for a hip problem, she doesn't have a hip problem, she could do that and send 14 bills to Washington. That's an example of the problem here. There's nobody controlling the total expenditure. The insurance companies will have to play that role of trying to help people not overdo it.
So you say that the insurance company tied in with the government is the better partnership than just the government alone.
It gives the government a little bit of buffer between them and the public. And then the insurance companies can also be working with the doctors and the hospitals to make sure that people have very good care, but that it's not overdone, that our country can't afford to let every single American see 14 doctors on the government's tab. It's just not feasible. So,
are there really that many 88-year-old women who are seeing 14 doctors? Most elderly people I know aren't getting enough health care.
Well, we have some people that aren't getting enough, and we have some people that are getting too much. And we have...
understand even that sentence,
The question is, who's going to pay for it? If it didn't cost their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren a huge amount, then I would say, fantastic, let's give every single elderly person a personal aid. There are things we can't afford, and this country is going bankrupt, paying for not just the Iraq War, but also this out-of-control healthcare spending. And we also have Social Security, which is 20% underfinanced. So we have a huge fiscal crisis looming ahead, and this and the previous administration made sure that things are really bad.
Well, let's contrast your plan to some of the ones that we're hearing from the presidential candidates. Democrats are largely basing their plans on mandating that employers offer care or pay a fine and that people buy insurance or pay a fine or are taxed. Barack Obama is mandating care for children only. Major Republican candidates oppose mandates. They're focusing on tax breaks to help people afford health care. What's wrong with that incremental thinking?
Because we have a house that's burning down as we proceed to try and develop yet another new government mechanism to deal with these uninsured people. We have Medicare and Medicaid not being reformed. And if you look at the baby boomers, they're about to retire. When they retire, under current projections, they're going to get at least $50,000 per person in today's dollars when they're retired. If you multiply that by 77 million baby boomers, you've got almost $4 trillion a year that's coming at us as bills. We can't afford to let things continue the way they are. And the Democratic proposals, yes, they're trying to get to universal health care, but let's just get there. Let's just do it. The Medicaid system is terrible for the participants. As soon as you earn a little bit of money, you lose your health benefits. That's why we're, in effect, trapping people into poverty. Let us just simply take the money we're already spending in this very inefficient way and just use it to give everybody a voucher that's individually experience rated, let the insurance companies compete, and then let's put a lid on how much we spend every year as a share of GDP, and we will be in much better shape. Otherwise, we're heading the way of Argentina, frankly.
And we should add, Dennis Kucinich is one of the Democrats who says, make it completely universal care and do away with the huge insurance infrastructure.
Well, the insurance industry has a role to play here, and I'm for a very competitive private providers. The doctors should compete against each other. The hospitals should compete. If you just have the government running everything the way they may do in some other countries, that leads to lots of inefficiencies. That's not an American solution. I'm talking about a new American solution. And I'm not the only economist that's proposed this. I think lots of very good economists, Victor Fuchs at Stanford, Ezekiel Rahm at the NIH, they've also proposed this. So this is a solution for the adverse selection problem that's plaguing this market.
Lawrence Kotlikoff, professor of economics at Boston University and author of the new book, The Healthcare Fix. Larry, thanks for coming in to talk to us about it.
Hey, my pleasure.
Quick news note, members of Congress had the health of the economy on their minds today. Former Treasury Secretary and Harvard University President Lawrence Summers told the Joint Economic Committee that Congress should pass an economic stimulus bill of up to $150 billion, double what he'd previously called for. Top Democrats and Republicans will meet this afternoon on the issue. Democrats favor extending unemployment benefits and boosting food stamp payments. Republicans champion tax breaks. Well, still ahead today, the cyber curbside. It's freecycle.org. That's after the news, here and now. More than 30 years ago, Dr. Judah Folkman came up with a radical theory that cancer cells required a constant blood supply in order to thrive and grow, and that starving the tumors of blood would kill them. Well, his once scoffed at theory is now responsible for numerous cancer drugs being used by thousands of people. Dr. Folkman died unexpectedly Monday night of a heart attack en route to a medical conference in Vancouver, Canada. His sudden death has stunned the medical world. We want to talk to one of his colleagues. Dr. Donald Ingber is a friend of Judah Folkman's at Children's Hospital in Boston. He worked with him. Dr. Ingber, first of all, thank you so much for giving us some time on this day, which must be, it just must be a stunning one for all of you.
Well, we're definitely just taken aback and in shock. I mean, if anyone ever met Folkman, they know he was this whirlwind of energy and forward motion that just we never believed anything could stop. So we're just sort of thrown forward as he stopped.
Even at 74, he was going full bore. We want to talk about what he's been talking about recently and what you had talked to him about. But let's remind everyone what he did. This discovery, this realization of his to block the blood flow to tumors, how controversial was that?
Well, for the last 30 years, the whole field of cancer research has been dominated by focusing on the growth of the tumor cell itself, and I think Folkman was way ahead understanding, probably because of his clinical experience, that this is a disease of the tissue and the organ, not just a single cell. And so he made this incredible insight when he was in the Navy, of all places, that tumors would not grow unless they could induce the formation of new capillary blood vessels to deliver oxygen and nutrients, just like any other cell. And so his idea was that you could literally starve it or restrict its growth by inhibiting the growth of those blood vessels.
All right. And, you know, it wasn't the first time that he said something that was dismissed or did something that was dismissed. He was on the front lines in other ways as well. You mentioned that he took funding at one point, and that was very controversial.
Everyone knows of Folkman being the focus of the New York Times article where they said he had a cancer cure just around the corner. But before that, there was a huge article in Science Magazine, the journal in our world, attacking him for selling out to industry in the 1974, when he received the first major grant from a company, Monsanto, at the time. But in retrospect, that was another field he pioneered, because now that is the keeps science going as the government's cutting back its funding, and you have to collaborate with industry to bring a discovery to the bedside, because they know how to do product development and clinical trials, et cetera. So yeah, he was very used to being attacked.
Well, and he kept hold of his work. He didn't give it away and kept his integrity as well. But you mentioned the New York Times article. This was the huge front page story. After his thinking about blocking the blood to tumors, he carried out research in mice that was groundbreaking. But it was misrepresented by the New York Times. Big front page story that literally said, I remember picking it up and reading it, cancer is cured. And there was a quote in there?
Yeah, well, I mean, the New York Times got it so wrong. In fact, there was 2 months before that, there was a drug that I had discovered with Folkman that was published in the New England Journal that had actually been tested in humans and had caused some regressions in patients. They never even mentioned that. They all focused on this work in mice. It was unbelievably bizarre. But you know, he didn't say that it was a cure. They said it was a cure.
But in fact, who said it? Who said that he was about to have a cure?
James Watson, the Nobel Prize winner, who has recently received press for not most noble of reasons.
For speaking his mind in other ways and getting in trouble. But in this case, he said that Judah Folkman is about to find this cure for cancer. And Dr. Folkman, who had made so much progress in his research with mice, actually had to spend several days sort of, instead of getting the credit for what he did do, tamping down what he hadn't yet done.
I think that's right on, and it was months more than days. And I think that, to be fair, I think Watson's enthusiasm was that Folkman had really discovered a whole new approach to cancer therapy, which in fact is true. And the head of the FDA a few years ago said that angiogenesis inhibition is now the fourth major modality for treating cancer, along with radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery. It's just in its embryonic phases, only the first drugs over the transom are out there. They're not always the best, the first drugs, and it's going to get better and better. But it's really changing cancer from a disease that, you know, from thinking about it as something you cure to something you manage.
What are some of those drugs, by the way? Just name them so we're reminded.
Well, the big blockbuster drug is Avastin. Genentech developed that, and its first-year sales were the largest in history for a new cancer drug. The same drug has been repackaged as Lucentis to treat blindness in patients with macular degeneration, and that is an unequivocal success. The article in the New England Journal reporting it used the word miraculous, which I don't think I've ever seen before in a science journal. Something like 40% of patients who are legally blind can now drive a car. It reversed the disease, something that we didn't really expect. We expected to sort of slow it. So, I mean, everyone, you know, gives the soundbite of cancer, but really what Folkman was all about was saying that the blood vessels, the capillary blood vessels, are in all organs and are critical for control of their physiology, not only cancers. And this meant that they also contributed to many diseases you wouldn't think of as being related, including rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, many, many others.
But when you speak of this, we spoke earlier this morning, and in addition to just the shock of losing this great citizen, it was the heartbreak of thinking, well, oh my gosh, you know, he almost had this cure. He had almost done something. And you reminded me that he already did it, because the concern is, does this stop perhaps the remarkable light switch cure that everyone is looking for, the end of cancer, period? And you reminded me that, well, you know, that may not happen, but he's already done, you know, the incremental work to cutting back on it.
Well, I think that, you know, for those in science who know what's happening, there are over a million patients on angiogenesis inhibitor drugs in over 30 countries, and it's being used. And there are many drug companies working on drugs for all these other applications like arthritis and psoriasis and many others. Plus, he developed the first angiogenic factors that stimulate blood vessel growth, which are being pursued for treating heart attack, to get blood vessels to regrow around an infarct, wound healing. It's unbelievable. I really think he'll be someone, his name will be remembered 100 years from now, and he's already had the impact. It's just, it's an incremental change, because it takes so long to get, you know, the better and better drugs in. It's analogous to the first antibiotic, you know, in the 30s versus wide-spectrum antibiotics now. I think we're really, he has changed the way we think about cancer and how we treat cancer. It's just not a cure, a black and white silver bullet cure. It is, you know, management over time.
And Dr. Ingberg, your title is actually the Judah Folkman Professor of Vascular Biology at Children's Hospital. You hold the Folkman chair, and I know that now you hold it even more dearly. Thanks so much for spending some time with us to talk about your colleague and friend, Dr. Judah Folkman, who died unexpectedly yesterday at the age of 74 after a heart attack. And you at Children's Hospital will be continuing his work. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. 2007 was a big year for the environment, with Al Gore winning an Oscar and a Nobel Peace Prize for his part in turning the world's attention to climate change, many people becoming better, greener consumers. But what happens after we consume? As Francis Moore LePay, author of Diet for a Small Planet, writes, there is no away to which we throw our stuff. So we suggest, how about sharing? Darren Beal is the founder and executive director of FreeCycle.org. It's a grassroots online movement that claims more than 4 million members in 4,000 cities around the world, keeping 400 tons of waste a day out of landfills. It all started in Tucson, Arizona. Darren Beal joins us from his office there with more. Darren, how does FreeCycle work?
Well, basically it's like a cyber curbside, because we're asking people to give things away that they'd otherwise be throwing away. So basically you just go to FreeCycle.org, you find your local group, and you join it. It's all free. It's all nonprofit. And if you're looking to give something away, you offer it in the local group. And if you're looking to get something, you ask for it in the local group. So it's pretty simple.
I'm online right now, and I see that somebody wants a toaster oven and twin box springs. But Kat, who had been offering a bag of fabric, says the fabric scraps have been claimed. So she was keeping track of that. What rules do you have? I mean, so that you weed out people who just want to get stuff.
Yeah. Well, our basic rule is keep it free, legal, and appropriate for all ages. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely family-friendly. And, you know, ultimately, we're giving things away that would otherwise be thrown away. So if someone's just looking to get something, well, that's not the end of the world, because otherwise we'd be throwing that item away.
You make a distinction on your website between what FreeCycle is and what it's not. You say it's not a place to go and just get free stuff, because there is a community of giving.
Yeah, actually, I think what you also see is that people may join because they think, oh, I can get something for free. But ultimately, they become passionate givers, because it's a darn much fun having someone come to your front doorstep, thank you effusively for this item that you're actually planning to have to lug to a landfill anyway. A good example of that, the first item I ever posted was a bed. My wife and I were getting married. Goodwill doesn't take beds. None of my friends needed a bed. What was I going to do with this thing? It was headed for the brush and bulky trash. So you get this kind of aha effect or paradigm shift when you realize how beautiful it is, how good it feels to have someone thank you for giving them something. I think that's the ultimate gift that's being given.
Yeah, we've seen people who, you know, have just really been destitute and needed something like a bed to them as just an incredible gift, and there it is. We know that you worked for a nonprofit recycling group in Tucson, which is where you got this idea. You just mentioned an aha, but what was the light bulb moment for FreeCycle?
My boss said I had to give away a warehouse full of stuff. So we would travel around downtown picking up recyclables with guys who were moving out of shelters and into apartments, hanging around a lot of dumpsters. And while doing that, we would see perfectly good stuff that wasn't recyclable. And it was a great chance to give it to these guys for their new apartments. But we ended up getting so popular that we were gathering more junk than we could give away. And I said, there's got to be an easier way to do this. Free recycling. What shall I call it? And thus, FreeCycle.org was born.
What are some of the strangest things that you've seen exchanged on FreeCycle?
I personally gave away 2 tons of urbanite.
What is that?
It's actually, I just took out my driveway, and that's a nice way of saying a bunch of hunks of old concrete, urbanite.
Somebody wanted that?
They used it for the foundation of a straw bale home. And another group picked up some. They pieced it back together for a patio for the School for the Deaf and Blind here in Tucson. And a third group picked them up, and they made a park bench out of them.
That's something. The one that I'm seeing that strikes me as interesting is someone's looking for a yoga mat.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want somebody's old used yoga mat.
Yeah, no, and but somebody else will want it, right?
Obviously.
There was one post once, a woman who dyed her hair black, and she still had half of the hair dye left over, and said, is tonight your night to go black, you know? Now, maybe I don't want her half a container of black hair dye, but, you know, somebody will. I guarantee she probably got 5 or 10 emails on that one, so you just never know.
Darren Beal, executive director and founder of FreeCycle.org, speaking from his home office and the home base in Tucson, Arizona. Darren, thanks.
Thank you, and thank you also to the 4.2 million people out there giving it away now.
When we come back, the music of Amy Winehouse. She's been nominated for 6 Grammys. Back in a minute, here and now. One of the big questions ahead of next month's Grammy Awards is, will the extremely talented and extremely troubled British soul singer Amy Winehouse make an appearance? And should she? She's nominated for 6 awards, including Album of the Year for her CD, Back to Black, and Song and Record of the Year for the ubiquitous tune that fueled T-shirts and headlines, rehab.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no.
It's not just an act. Alcohol and drugs are two of the problems plaguing Winehouse. In the fall, she canceled her concert tour after some shaky performances, and her equally troubled husband is in jail on charges of assault and attempted trial fixing, all of which threatens what many critics agree is a huge talent. Here to talk about all of this, here now, pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, nice to see you as always.
Good to see you, Robin.
And you knew Amy Winehouse from her first album. You were familiar with her. We're going to talk about that album. But some of us who really enjoyed Rehab and maybe discovered her then are now feeling like enablers. You know, we loved the song, but it's really not funny. She really didn't want to go to rehab.
It's a great song, and it, the song reflected some problems she had prior to the release of Back to Black, where her record company, you know, saw that she was having some issues and wanted her to get some help. And that's what the song talks about, how they wanted her to go and she felt no need to.
Directly afterwards, you know, directly after having become such a huge hit, we started seeing why they wanted to go, her to go to rehab, you know, so blatantly. You know, she's a huge hit as a cultural icon. Your former colleague Joan Anderman at the Boston Globe wrote that, you know, her look, the, well, how would you describe it, the eyeliner and everything?
You know, it's the tough girl 1960s look, you know, the big brassy beehive and the eyeliner and the tank tops. She's got these sort of hardcore tattoos up and down her arms. She's not what you would expect from a soul singer.
Right, and that was all the rage at Halloween, although she was just named on the top 10 worst dressed list. That style, how about substance, the voice? I mean, who would you compare it to?
You know, you really can't compare her voice to anyone else's. When her first album came out, it was called Frank. It came out in 2003, and it seemed like it just came out of nowhere. She was only 20 years old, but she had this seasoned, soulful voice. And what was really outstanding about the album was the jazz inflection. So there were comparisons to Billie Holiday, to Sarah Vaughan, to Dinah Washington. She doesn't sound like any of those women, taking nothing away from her, but she has her own style. And I think we'll hear it a little bit on this version she did of Moody's Mood for Love, which is Eddie Jefferson's vocalese version of James Moody's Mood for Love.
Amy Winehouse's take on all of it.
Yes.
Pretty baby, you are the soul who snaps my control. Such a funny thing, but every time you're near me, I never can behave. You give me a smile and then I'm wrapped up in your magic. There's music all around me, crazy music, music that keeps calling me. So
it's just great. You know, it's just
great.
And
remember, she's 20 years old.
Yeah. So Frank is, you know, as you say, kind of jazzy, but there, of course, she had her soul there, too.
Right. I mean, there are jazzy inflections in the album, but it's not a jazz album at all. A lot of the music is informed by soul and R&B, as we'll hear in this next cut, Know You Now.
Amy Winehouse from her first CD, Frank, but it's Back to Black that's been nominated for all those Grammys. So what leaps out at you about that CD, Renee?
The first cut on the album is Rehab. So obviously when you have that opening line, they tried to make me go to rehab, and I said no, no, no. You laugh and you think it's funny, but then the album progresses, and there's so much maturity. Her lyrics and her voice, they're weary and wise, but also undefeated. There's a lot of defiance in the way she sings, and I think there's something really refreshing about that. I mean, you know, hands down, she's the best female singer to come out of Britain since Dusty Springfield.
Yeah, so let's listen. Here's Dusty.
You don't have to say you love me, just be close and have.
Here's Amy Winehouse.
You can't keep lying to yourself like this. Can't believe you play.
This is Me and Mr. Jones. Now, there's only a small part we can play on the radio, but you say this is one of your favorites. Why?
I love this song because, again, it has this attitude to it. It also has, it's a word we can't, unfortunately, we can't play on the radio, but it is just such a wonderful word. It so describes sort of an irritating or aggravating situation. And just the way she does it, it's got these sort of little horns, it's got this girl group innocence, but the song is not innocent. And that's the difference between her and some of the girl groups people have compared her to. There's no innocence in her music. There's a lot of living in those lyrics.
Renee Graham, I'm also hearing a little, you know, except for the lyrics, what a difference a day makes, you know, 24 little hours, you know,
that's
all that.
Where, you know, that's where you hear the Dinah Washington. Yeah. You know, also have to give props to the Dap Kings, who are the band who backed her up on this. They're absolutely fantastic, and they just nail that vintage sound.
So, what do you see happening? I mean, she's been compared to Janis Joplin for the wonder of her voice, but we know what happened in that story.
But they also compare her to Janis Joplin because Janis Joplin died much too young. I think the difficult thing with Amy Winehouse is how much her troubles have come to overshadow her music. You know, this was, you know, hands down one of the best albums of 2007. That's why she's got 6 Grammy nominations. She's not nominated for Grammys because she's got a drug problem. She's nominated because the music is fresh, it's invigorating, but it also has this sort of wonderful retro feel without seeming like it's also trapped in the past.
Okay, but here's the question. I kind of hate this question, but you know people ask it, Renee. Oh, but if she weren't so tragic and troubled, would the music be so good?
I think that's nonsense. I mean, you know, does the classic Folsom Prison Blues have any less impact because Johnny Cash never actually shot a man in Reno just to watch him die? No. Good music should be good music. I think that all kinds of things inform that music, but I don't think her music is great because of her personal tragedies.
Well, and funny you should mention Johnny Cash, because he's someone who, you know, turned around his life and had been an alcoholic and had had some of those problems and, you know, dropped the problems and went on to even, some would say, a better career.
Let's wish the same for Amy Winehouse.
Well, we're not going to ask you to speculate, because what do we know about what direction Amy Winehouse is going to take? But if she does, you know, if it is a shortened career because she just can't, you know, get over these other problems, she joins a long list.
She joins a long list of a lot of people. You know, people always talk about, you know, the 27 Club with Kurt Cobain and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison, who all died at 27. Amy Winehouse, people forget, is only 24 years old. With the talent she has, there's no reason why we can't still be talking about her in 20 years. This is the woman who could put out a standards album. She is a monumental talent, but she's got some monumental problems to deal with as well.
Mm. That's Here Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham talking about the talented and troubled Amy Winehouse. Renee, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
One song you want us to go out on? What should we hear?
Tears Dry on Their Own.
He walks away, the sun goes down, he takes the day.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
We could have never had it all. We had to hit a wall. So this is never to fall withdrawal.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.